Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Never rely on what you think you know. Remember the Lord in everything you do, and He will show you the right way. Never let yourself think that you are wiser than you are. Simply obey the Lord and refuse to do wrong. Let us pray. Precious Jesus, may the water you have so graciously poured from your word into this earthen vessel be transformed by your Spirit into wine for the enlightening of our minds and the refreshing of our hearts for the glory of your name. Amen. My name is Peter, Simon Peter. I lived for years in the village of Capernaum on the shore of Galilee. In partnership with my father and my brother Andrew, I made a fair living as a fisherman. But that all changed after my encounter with the carpenter from Nazareth. Many things happened after I met him are stranger than any fish story you have ever heard. But there's one event that is so deeply etched into my memory that nothing can erase it. There was a silvery moon that evening as we left the city of Jerusalem and walked downhill toward the Kidron. On the far side of the star-kissed stream was a garden on the lower slopes of Mount of Olives. People called the place Oil Press, because it was here that the sweet-scented oil was pressed from the olives. We couldn't comprehend it at the time, but Jesus was about to be pressed and pressured beyond human endurance in this oil press place called Gethsemane. In the dark recesses of that olive grove, a stupendous cosmic conflict was about to unfold that would determine the eternal destiny of humanity. We'd often spent the night there before, so it was no surprise when Jesus told the rest of the disciples to make themselves comfortable near the entrance to the garden. And as he had so often done in the past, he urged them to pray. James and John and I accompanied Jesus as he pushed toward the heart of the garden. When we had been with him there on other occasions, we'd almost always talked about the significance of what had happened during the day. But that night, he was strangely silent. Never before had we seen him so utterly sad. None of us dared ask him why he was walking with such difficulty. It appeared as if he was laboring under a crushing load. We even had to steady him when he stumbled, for it seemed that his strength had forsaken him. As I put my arm around him so that he could lean on me, he cried out, "The pain in my heart is unbearable. It's killing me." Then he was silent again, except for his laboring breathing. As we approached his favorite prayer place, he told us to be vigilant and to pray for him and for ourselves. Then he knelt down just beyond where we were sitting and began to agonize in prayer. We had no idea what was going on. We went over the events of the evening, trying to find a clue about what was troubling him. We'd all been together for the Passover supper, and a mournful time that had been. Jesus kept trying to convince us that he was going to die in a gruesome manner, but that didn't make any sense to us. We knew from the prophecies that the Messiah was going to vanquish our enemies and establish a mighty dynasty, and we had no doubt that Jesus was the Messiah. So why was he being so morbid? Thinking back about it now, it is clear that he knew exactly what would happen. He even predicted that Judas would betray him, that I would disown him, and that everyone would forsake him. I remember with burning shame how I argued with him and declared that though all my cowardly companions might desert him, he could count on me to stand by him no matter what. I was about to utter a fisherman's oath to clinch my resolve when he interrupted me with the assertion that before tomorrow's rooster could trumpet the dawn, I would shout curses at those who accused me of knowing him. Of course, I didn't believe him. None of us believed that he would actually allow himself to be taken into custody and executed. How absurd that seemed. Whenever the authorities had tried to capture him in the past, he had easily eluded them. The very idea that the Messiah could be assassinated seemed preposterous. The ground beneath us was hard, and there was a chill in the air as we discussed these things in hushed whispers. Then we heard Jesus praying for us by name. He knew us so well. He understood exactly the weaknesses and frailties of each of us, and with deep compassion and earnestness, he pleaded that our faith would not fail, and that we would be spared from the violence and cruelty of his enemies. The solemn intensity of his pleading struck a chord of consternation in our hearts, and we also began to pray for our safety. Then we noticed that he seemed overwhelmed with despair. He was begging God to release him from a mysterious torment that was torturing his mind. But whether that fervently desired relief from suffering would come or not, he resolved to trust his Father's will and way. So we prayed earnestly for him too, because we had never seen him so depressed and discouraged before. In spite of our good intentions to support him through the dark night of his despondency, it wasn't long before we started yawning. And as the lateness of the hour poured its sleeping potion into our eyes, we yielded to exhaustion's embrace. I woke up startled and disoriented. Jesus was shaking me awake. I'll never forget the anguish in his voice as he said, "Oh, Peter, couldn't you even stay awake for 1 hour?" My big mouth bragging nature was strangely subdued at that moment. I'd insisted that I was ready to go with him to prison and to death. Now I was ashamed about how easy it was for me to sleep when I should have been watching for the approach of his enemies. A soldier who slept on guard duty would have been executed without mercy. But there was no reproach in his voice, no condemnation, just an aching sorrow and an unspoken plea for human consolation in his hour of desperate need. How I wish now that I'd gotten up and hugged him close and told him of my deep love and devotion. I'll never forgive myself for doing what was so easy and convenient for me instead of doing what he so desperately needed me to do for him. James and John had woken up by now, and Jesus told us that it was terribly important to pray for strength from God, so that we would not be swept away by the tempestuous temptations that were about to break over us. We did make a few feeble attempts to pray, but our hearts were not in it. We were frightened by what was happening to Jesus, and we were beginning to believe that we really were in grave and imminent danger. So, instead of fortifying ourselves for the conflict, we medicated our misery with sleep. I realize now that a lot more was at stake during the awful struggle than our immediate safety. Jesus had previously told us about the dreadful attack by Satan shortly before I first met him. He had found seclusion in the wilderness near Jericho in order to contemplate his mission. After 40 days of fasting and prayer, the devil, in the disguise of a messenger from heaven, had urged him to perform a miracle to save himself from starvation. Now, I don't know about you, but when I'm really, really hungry, nothing else seems to matter. I want to do whatever it takes to get some food in my belly. But it was different with Jesus. He asked himself, "Is this what my Father in heaven wants me to do now?" He decided that he would rather starve to death than to do anything that was contrary to the will of God. Next, the evil one tempted him to demonstrate that he was indeed the beloved Son of God by presuming upon God's protecting providence. But Jesus declared that it was God's will to trust him, not test him. Finally, the devil tempted Jesus to take the easy way out, to save himself from the torturous path that lay before him. But no matter how attractive the inducement, nothing could persuade Jesus to deviate from his Father's plan. Defeated at the start of Christ's ministry, Satan was determined to succeed at its close. So he summoned all the evil powers to exert maximum force against Jesus. All their repressive darkness was pressed in upon him until he feared that he would never see the light again. Face down on the ground, clutching at the earth, his agonized cry was stifled by the suffocating blanket of blackness. Taking advantage of Christ's weakened and vulnerable condition, Satan pressed his temptations in upon him with ferocious intensity. "All this suffering is a complete waste," he insisted. "No one appreciates what you're doing. Your closest friends are perfect examples of ingratitude. There they are, fast asleep, totally oblivious of what you're going through. Give it up. It's not worth it. Nobody cares. Besides, you know how selfish and self-absorbed people are. They are so caught up with their own pitiful lives that they won't even bother with what you are doing for them. It's all a terrible mistake. So much agony. So few who could possibly benefit from it. So many who will reject you." Staggering to his feet, Jesus came back to us, hoping to find some evidence to counteract the claims of Satan. But there we were, passed out like a bunch of drunks. We awoke at the sound of his voice and felt awful that we'd let him down again, but no words came. We just sat there dumbly looking at him until he kindly said, "I know that you intended to stay awake, but weariness overcame you." His compassion for our weakness was so undeserved, and yet so characteristic of his generous spirit. More than ever, he needed us to pray for him when he left us the third time. Yet it seemed that the more intensely he needed support, the less able we were to give it. When he most needed human companionship, he was most utterly alone. As he collapsed onto the ground again, his anguish intensified beyond imagining. Not only was Jesus suffering from the ravaging assaults of the legions of evil forces, he now felt that the weight of all the sins of the world was pressing down upon him. The guilt for every depraved atrocity, every act of debauchery, every wickedness committed from the dawn of time was torturing his sensitive soul. Frequent indulgence in sin has a deadening effect on the human heart and mind. Going against God's will numbs the conscience, distorts the moral perceptions, and destroys the sense of the sinfulness of sin. What initially seems abhorrent all too easily becomes passionately pleasurable. By absolute contrast, there was never the slightest desensitization of Christ's conscience, because he never sinned. Whenever he witnessed a wrong act, it caused him excruciating pain. And now every iniquity ever perpetrated was searing through his soul. His agony was so intense that blood forced through his pores mingled with a sweat that poured from his brow. As he accepted more and more responsibility and guilt for the commission of the accumulated sins of every person in earth's history, a new terror assailed him. He was losing his connection with his Father. Until this terrible travail, he had lived with a constant, intimate sense of his Father's presence. Not for a moment had the smile of his Father's approval ever faded from his vision. Jesus was now choosing to take upon himself the punishment for every sin committed, so that those who had committed the sins would not have to suffer the penalty they so richly deserved. Things now were terrifyingly different. As the absolutely fair and just judge, God must ensure that the punishment perfectly fits the crime. Not too little, not too much, not too lenient, not too severe. The punishment selected by God for every sin must be, and must be seen to be, exactly right in every way. The fury of a just God against iniquity must be poured out without mixture into the cup of his indignation. Retribution for all the pain and suffering ever experienced by humankind as a consequence of sin must be distilled into the bitter cup that must be drunk to the dregs by the sin bearer. The ultimate punishment for sin is eternal separation from the giver of life. And it was this horror, this terror of seeing his Father turning away from him, leaving him, forsaking him, that crushed the heart of Christ with unutterable anguish. The agony was unbearable. He collapsed, absolutely overwhelmed. He lay dying. But he must not die yet. He must not die until he has emptied the mysterious cup to the very last drop. In order to endure what it is impossible for human nature to survive, his capacity to suffer must be increased. We were aroused by an exceedingly bright light, and as our eyes gradually adjusted, we saw an angel cradling the head of Jesus in his arms, reviving and strengthening him. I remember the time when James and John and I had been together with Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration, and how Moses and Elijah had appeared and encouraged Jesus and assured him of his Father's love. Somehow that memory and the presence of the angel relieved our anxiety. We felt sure that Jesus was in good hands and that we didn't need to worry anymore. So we relaxed and gradually succumbed to slumber. I have no recollection of anything the angel said, but I imagine that he told Jesus that all of Satan's assertions were false. I'm sure that he comforted him with the assurance that multitudes of people would gratefully accept his great sacrifice for them. And I also like to believe that he reminded Jesus of Mary Magdalene and how she lavished the fragrance of her love upon his head and washed his feet with tears of gratitude for all that he had done for her. As the angel left and light receded, the memory of Mary's devotion cheered the heart of Jesus as he sank back down into the utmost depths of darkness. The storm that had abated for a brief moment lashed him with tenfold fury. The weight of the world's woe pressed down upon him with unrelenting intensity. And the worst of all the wrath of God against sin was now fully focused on him. Though supernaturally strengthened to endure superhuman agony, Christ's sensitivity to suffering was not diminished. Stretched to the utmost limits on the rack of human extremity, Jesus must now face the ultimate life or death question. Will he follow his strong survival urges and save his life? Or choose the worst possible death so that others can live? Will he drink the bitter cup, take into himself the venomous poison? Or will he walk away and leave man to drink his own cup of infinite woe? The onlooking universe held its breath. The destiny of humanity trembled in the balance. The Prince of Sufferers groaned from the depths of his being. And through parched lips, he cried, "Oh, my Father, please take away this dreadful cup from me. But if you really want me to drink it, I will." In that moment, the salvation of humanity was assured. The God-man had accepted all of humanity's punishment and freely chosen to die as man's substitute. His death throes that began on that darkest midnight of Earth's history would intensify until mid-afternoon the next day, when he would drain the last drop from the chalice of suffering. Although years have passed, the memory of what happened that night is as fresh as if it happened last night. I've been back to that oil press place many times since. I like to sit and quietly contemplate what happened there. It always strikes me that the story of Gethsemane builds intensity towards a non-climax. One would think that there should be some amazing dramatic action by Jesus that will dazzle humankind with his brilliance and power. Instead, he simply submits. As I think about it, it seems that submission is the essence of life. We're always giving in to something. In the Garden of Eden, Eve gave in to the suggestions of the serpent. Adam yielded to his wife's temptation. Cain gave in to his anger, became the first murderer. Moses yielded to frustration. David gave in to lust. Jonah gave in to his fears. James and John yielded to their indignation and were ready to call down fire to destroy Samaria. And I yielded to my injured pride and impetuously drew a sword and sliced off the ear of Malchus. But Jesus was very selective about submission. He would not yield to Satan's temptations. He refused to give in to the yearnings of his body and mind that so eloquently cried out for relief from suffering. But he did submit to the will of his Father. When the soldiers and the mob came to arrest him in the garden, he demonstrated his power And they all fell backward in amazed confusion. He made it clear that he was going to submit to them by choice, not because of their force of numbers. And he did submit to the cruelest abuse, but only because that was part of the price to be paid for our salvation. I stand in awe at his ability to know when to submit, and to whom, and how much. When he was struck through the face in the judgment hall, he confronted his assailant with the declaration, "If I've spoken evil, your action may be understandable. But I spoke well, so why did you strike me?" His submission wasn't a weak surrender because he had no other option. He submitted when it was right to do so and consistently refused to submit to wrong. You may be asking why all this is so important to me. Well, that's because I'm Simon Peter, the big fisherman. I'm dominant and controlling, impetuous and impulsive. I speak before I think and I act without considering the consequences. At least, that's the way it used to be. The more I think about Jesus and the way he lived, the more like him I want to be. And so I'm changing. I'm changing because he has put within me a desire to be changed. The power of his grace in my life is refining me. I'm less likely to push myself forward now, more willing to submit to the counsel and suggestions from my fellow Christians. It's pretty amazing. None of my old friends can believe that the boastful, opinionated Peter they once knew could ever become kind and considerate. But that's exactly what's happening in my life. The changes have come about because I'm doing what Jesus did, surrendering my will to the will of God. Yes, that's what it's all about. It's the ultimate question. Will I choose his will or my will? Will I do what he wants or what I want? His way or my way? It's easy when what he wants is also what I want. But it runs against the grain when he wants me to do something I really don't want to do. My ideas clash with his when he insists that what I truly want to do is just plain wrong. It's a taxing test of my loyalty to him when everyone else is urging me to go along with them and he calls me to go in the opposite direction. It's a bitter test when he insists that I denounce long-established habits and turn my back on what gives me pleasure. For sure, it's not easy to hear him say, "Any of you who does not forsake, renounce, surrender claim to, give up, say goodbye to all that he has, cannot be my disciple." My self-preservation instinct screams, "No, no, no," when he says, "Come and die." But despite my resistance, despite the urgent demands of my old nature, despite the relentless pull of the most alluring temptations, it still makes perfect sense to me to do what he wants me to do. My heart affirms the absolute truth that I must demonstrate here and now that I'm unequivocally committed to doing things his way. No excuses. No exceptions, no rationalizations, his way. not my way. Otherwise, even though I'm loved by him with an infinite love, if I insist on doing things my way, I'll forfeit the eternal joy of being with Jesus. There is a way, a broad, attractive way that seems so very right to us. But his way, the narrow upward way, is the very best way of all.